Well, some of you who have been following the news know that we have a case of Ebola down in Texas. Gentleman actually flew in from Liberia, and he was coming over here to get married, and he got sick, and they didn't really diagnose him right away. And then after a few return visits to the hospital, they figured out that he had Ebola, and they put him and his family in quarantine. I just got a note today through the fax from the Colorado Department of Health, giving us information on screening for Ebola. And here's a poster that they suggest we post around. If somebody's coming in from Liberia or what is it, Guinea or Sierra Leone, then and they have any of these symptoms, then we're supposed to sort of keep track of them. Well, Ebola. Interesting disease. Sort of hit the news a few years ago. It's sort of rare, but very deadly. It causes bleeding inside and outside the body. It's very reminiscent of the 1918 pandemic influenza called the Spanish influenza. It's been usually hitting people in Africa, and we'll talk about why that is. The virus belongs to a group of single-stranded RNA viruses, and it's called a filoviridae. It's for filament. It looks like a worm, but it's not a worm. It's just a virus, and it's got this one long strand of genetic code, and it sticks that genetic code into your body and makes you into a virus factory. They don't really know what its natural reservoir is. In other words, does it live in mosquitoes? Does it live? No, it doesn't live in mosquitoes. Does it live in? Well, we don't know. They find it in primates, in other words, monkeys. They find it in other areas. And history of it is interesting. It was named after a river, Ebola River, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly Zaire. And it started out over there. There were two species, a Zaire species and a Sudan species. And the Zaire species was a little more fatal, very high fatality rates, at least over in Africa. And they have a third species that showed up in the Philippines, largely in pigs, but some in monkeys. And on the Ivory Coast, they had one scientist that got it. So that's sort of an interesting occurrence. All right, so it's the family filoviruses really first got its debut in the news when the Marburg virus showed up. Now, how did we get a Marburg virus? Well, the Marburg virus is named after Marburg, Germany, where they were making vaccines. And they were making vaccines on kidney cell cultures from monkeys. And so they were making your vaccine for polio off of monkey kidneys. And lo and behold, a bunch of viruses showed up and a bunch of people died in Germany. This was 1967. And there's a whole article on the dangerous impurities in vaccines, but this is from one of the famous vaccine conferences in Washington, D.C., where they talk about the fact that a lot of our vaccines have more viruses from monkeys and pigs and chickens and so forth than they have the virus you're supposed to be being treated for. It's a little scary. And this whole concept of things coming from animals is called zoonosis, where we have different animals carrying different types of diseases, like viruses, and Ebola is a virus, and you end up getting that disease. So some people did some study on this over in Africa to see what the connection was like. And the reason people get it so much in Africa isn't because they're all coughing on each other, it's because they're eating foods that contain the viruses. One big study or one big case was where they found a dead chimpanzee. They decided to eat it, and all 19 of the people who decided to eat it came down with Ebola. And so this is sort of an interesting connection. They call it bush meat. They eat anything that walks, crawls, or can't get away. And here's bats. Bats are also considered a reservoir or a source. And sort of reminds us of the Levitical charge that it's better not to eat certain things God didn't create for eating because, well, you might end up with Ebola. Now, the World Health Organization sort of put together this slide where they said that it can be stored in bats. Bats put their droppings down in the ground. The pigs are very susceptible and carriers for the Ebola. And then it gets into the food chain, and then people can start transmitting it to each other. And notice the healthcare workers. There's one hospital over in Africa where they brought in a patient with Ebola, but nobody really realized it. The sanitary practices in the hospital weren't really up to what we would consider standards here. They basically used needles over and over and over again without proper sterilization. Pretty soon everybody in the hospital had it, and they all the patients died, and then most of the medical staff died, and they just closed the hospital. And so how is it transmitted? I mean, that's a good question if we're going to follow this thing. And certainly it can be passed with any kind of body fluids, ingestion, inhalation, passage through breaks in the skin. This is sort of the classic thing. Direct contact with any body fluids, blood, vomit, urine, feces, semen, secretions. Even after somebody's been sick with it and they supposedly get well, they can have it in their semen for months after that. Sweat, probably. Any organs or contaminated surfaces. And like we mentioned, needles can be a problem. Now, over in Africa, they sort of get rather physically involved in their funeral services and their burial services. And it's part of their, maybe their animistic religion, but they've tended to spread this thing around. This has happened before, like other diseases, like what we think of as mad cow disease, but kuru, over in down under Papua New Guinea and so forth. And so dealing with dead bodies has been a problem for some of these cultures. Contact with infected animals, and so hunting, butchering, preparing the meat, different animals that have been known to have this, chimpanzees, gorillas, bats, pigs, forest antelopes. And so they sort of have their recommendations for these folks that if they're going to be involved with this animal preparation, that they should follow good hygienic practices during that time and afterwards. How about airborne transmission? This has been sort of debated a lot. And some people have been saying, no, it can't be airborne transmitted. It won't go in the air. Well, certainly if I, you know, cough on you and particles with the bug in them get on you, you could catch it. And in fact, animal studies show that chimpanzees can pass it to other chimpanzees through the air. It's not quite as infectious as, say, you know, the swine flu or any influenza, but it still can go through the air. And so you kind of wonder about this gentleman that came over from Liberia on an airplane for who knows how many hours, probably 16 hours. And everybody's in that airplane and everything's getting recirculated. You know, it could still be a problem. The incubation period can be short to long, 2 to 21 days. And it's not really contagious during the early stages, but later on it becomes very contagious, and we have to watch these people very closely. There's no evidence that it's being carried around by mosquitoes or arthropods. It's not necessarily a bug involved in this. So what happens when you get the virus? Well, it enters your body either through mucous membranes, that could be around your eyes, your nose, your mouth, breaks in the skin, or even your digestive tract, eating something that had Ebola. It can infect many cells. It's sort of like AIDS in that it goes after your immune system. Monocytes, dendritic cells, macrophages, and then it can also get into endothelial cells, fibroblasts, hepatocytes, that's your liver, adrenal cells, and epithelial cells. So it can go a lot of places, grab a lot of cells, and it starts to make those cells into a virus factory. Your body makes the viruses after that. Viruses can really not replicate on their own out in the environment, but they do replicate inside your cells. Your cells become the factory. the breeding ground. They spread to the lymph nodes and from there to different parts of the body. And there's a really rapid systemic spread. And then, just like the flu, it shuts down your body's natural ability to make antiviral interferon. So it shuts down the immune system. It's like the burglar that can come into your house and turn off the burglar alarm. And then it makes havoc. And so it's sort of an interesting bug. So it gets in the cells, especially monocytes, starts to make the monocytes into factories. It causes the release of inflammatory mediators. It makes inflammation. It makes your body inflame itself. And this is really the pathophysiological problem. It makes you your own destroyer. The macrophages, infected with especially the Zaire one, which is the bad one, produce a lot of tumor necrosis factor. This is a very potent inflammatory mediator. It makes a lot of inflammation in your body. And then the body's response is a lot of fever. Malaise are not feeling good. Your blood vessels get dilated and they increase vascular permeability, meaning that fluid leaks out into your tissues. You get swelling, you get pain, and then you get low blood pressure and you go into shock. It's sort of a septic picture. We call it sepsis when your body does this. Then you get these coagulation defects. What's coagulation? That's how your blood knows to stop bleeding when you get cut. It's coagulating. And it's sort of like making milk into yogurt. It got coagulated. Well, when your blood coagulates, it plugs up holes so you don't bleed anymore. Well, this virus messes with your coagulation system, and so you start bleeding everywhere. The infected macrophages put off a tissue factor that starts the coagulation cascade, and pretty soon you use up all your coagulation factors. Disseminated intravascular coagulopathy, meaning that you used all your resources. I don't have any more. You know the Dutch boy that put his finger in a dike? You don't have any more Dutch boys to put the finger in a dike. And you start bleeding. And then the liver gets injured, and that's where the factors are supposed to be coming from. And so you don't have the factory to make any more. And so the final common pathways, people tend to bleed an awful lot, and that's sort of where they end up deteriorating. Well, let's look at what you might expect if you're getting the Ebola. The clinical features are divided into four phases. So we'll look at four parts. The first part is, I got it. First day that I start getting symptoms. And for all you know, you could have the flu. I mean, it could be just like the flu. It's hard to sort out. Your fever might be over 101.5 with chills. You might get weakness and exhaustion, severe headache, muscle and joint pain, abdominal pain, sore throat, nausea, loss of appetite, and dizziness. But you get that with a common flu, too. So it's hard to tell the difference. But with Ebola, the next phase is it gets worse, gets more acute. And so the fever doesn't respond to any of the normal things that, well, in Africa, they start giving them things for malaria and antibiotics and so forth, but the fever doesn't respond. And then the headache gets more intense, more fatigue. You start getting diarrhea, abdominal pain, really don't want to eat, vomiting. And then there's sort of a false sense of security in that the next phase is remission. Oh, I feel better on day 7. It's been a week. I must be getting fine again. And some people do get better at that point. But it isn't necessarily true that everybody will get better. In fact, some people end up deteriorating after that, and that goes into the really aggravated stage. And that's where all those things we talked about that were really bad start happening. In most cases, the health worsens, your lungs get hit hard, you have trouble breathing, your chest hurts, you get cough and hiccup. This bleeding problem happens everywhere where you start bleeding. If somebody stuck you with a needle to take your blood, then it starts bleeding there. You might get coughing up blood or throwing up blood, nosebleeds. all kinds of bleeding. And then even if you don't have a place to bleed out, it might bleed under your skin, and you get what we call petechiae, or little blood spots under your skin, or purpura, bigger blood spots under your skin. And your brain, you don't feel so good, you don't think so good, your brain really goes haywire. You get delirium, confusion, coma, and the heart isn't functioning too good as you go into shock. And then that's usually where people end up not making it. So there's the clinical picture. How do we diagnose it? It's all high tech. Usually PCR labs or special types of ELISA assays where you're looking for certain proteins and certain DNA strands. It's something that has to be done by a hospital or the World Health Organization or CDC. It's not a lot of usual things. And so, CDC website talks about what do you do if you just traveled to an area and everybody had this bug. Well, you want to especially practice careful hygiene. Don't get yourself exposed to other people's body fluids. Don't handle items that had body fluids on them. Avoid any of these fancy burial or funeral services where people are handling other people that are dead. Avoid contact with the animals we know are a problem, bats, monkeys, their food, their blood, their meat. And if you know there's Ebola in a hospital overseas, you don't want to go to that hospital. You want to go to a hospital on a U.S. Embassy or base or something, military base. And after you return, you want to be sure and monitor your health closely for 21 days. That's the CDC's recommendation. But let's just go back to this similarity to the 1918 pandemic called Spanish influenza. It was very similar to the Ebola virus. And in fact, many of the things happened similarly where you had all these inflammatory cytokines. It shut down the immune system's ability to make interferon. And in that pandemic, we saw 675,000 deaths in the United States. That's a lot of people. And there was about a 30% attack rate with that particular pandemic, where out of 100 people, 30 people had come down with it. Well, that should be somewhat encouraging, because we should try to be among those 70 that didn't get it, right? Even though 30 got it. If 30% of the population in the United States got it today, that'd be 90 million people with a terrible illness. And so this is sort of scary. It cost a lot of money, too. So it's interesting that these kind of things are going on. And once it takes off exponentially. Here's Guinea and Liberia and Sierra Leone. And you can see all of them, once they started getting cases, the rise in the number of cases was dramatic, exponential, as we say. And so that's right up to August here this year. So maybe the one case hits Texas, and then four people get it, and then 40 people get it, and then 400, 4,000. You know, it just goes up fast. Well, pestilence, you know, infectious disease. This has been somewhat predicted. I just want to bring that out because it's interesting. In Luke, Jesus talking says, "Then said he unto them, Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and great earthquakes shall be in divers places, and famines, and pestilences, and fearful signs, and great signs shall be from heaven." And then a few verses later, "And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory." So some of this stuff is predicted. And so, well, has it been predicted how to take care of it? Well, one other text here in Exodus sort of brings out that if thou wilt diligently hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, and do that which is right in his sight, including maybe not eating monkeys, huh? And wilt give ear to his commandments and keep his statutes, he says, I will put none of these diseases upon thee which I brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that healeth thee. So, practical stuff, huh? What about vaccinations? Needling the immune system, I say here. Because we just noted that the first appearance of Ebola was when they put it in vaccines inadvertently. Well, a lot of these vaccines can cause problems other than the disease for which they're given. Receiving a hepatitis B vaccine increases the odds of acquiring multiple sclerosis by 420%. All this is documented, of course. We'll give you a handout at the end that shows you all the medical references. Lupus erythematosus by 800%, and rheumatoid arthritis by 1700%. And it has to do with some of the other junk that's in there, not just what they're trying to treat. Well, what about a mask? Should I wear a mask? Well, it wouldn't hurt to wear a mask. Probably not that mask, though. The masks that are recommended are the N95 respirators. Actually, you know the one I would get? You go to Lowe's and you go to the paint department, and they sell one that has carbon in it, and it claims to take the odor of the paint out. That's the one I would use. In fact, that's the one I do use when I'm dealing with environmental toxins or biohazards and mold and that kind of thing. So you want an N95. The N95 is sort of telling you what percent of the viruses will be removed, and in this case it's 95%. You need a certain number of viruses to make you sick. If you can cut down the number below the threshold to make you sick, then you're safe. These surgical masks we put on patients so they don't cough Ebola or flu all over creation, but they don't really protect the person wearing it because it's not tight around the nose, or, you know, air can come in around it. It's not totally tight. So one of the big projects that they think about when they want to control Ebola is quarantine. And so quarantine is taking people who are likely infected or likely exposed and putting them out of circulation. Like in Texas, they basically put four people under house arrest. Well, not really house arrest, but they have to stay home. And they can't go out in society and spread their viruses. And they're feeding the people. I mean, do you have 21 days worth of food on hand? Or at least they're feeding this first family that got sick. But what if everybody in Dallas got Ebola? You know, they're not going to come around and feed everybody. So maybe you should have at least 21 days worth of food in your house. They might not let you go down to the fast food joint to get anything. And then once the thing takes off, they sort of give up on quarantine, but they keep social distancing in mind. And social distancing is keeping a certain amount of distance between individuals. This comes from studies in prisons and in schools, like in Chicago, where they discovered that if you keep at least 6 feet between individuals, the number of communicable diseases that get passed between individuals goes down dramatically. And have you heard it said, I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole? Well, now you get a 6-foot pole, but you keep your distance. And now, cities are the hotbed for disease. I mean, really, pandemics didn't make their way into historical records until cities reached the critical size of 250,000. And once you get a city that large, like in 1918, a bug could come in one side of the city, and it would start going around the city in multiple passes, and each time it went around, it would get more infectious, more dangerous, more virulent, and more people would die. And that's what they attribute some of the virulence of the 1918 pandemic to. And so you might want to stay away from cities. If you're in a little farm community, the disease might come in, go out, and never make a second pass, and you don't get that, well, hybridization or whatever that makes the bug worse. And it's interesting that Jeremiah says, I will smite the inhabitants of the city, both man and beast. They shall die of a great pestilence. Not that that predicts anything for our time, but just the association between cities and pestilence goes way back to B.C. Now, let's talk about prevention. I mean, it's one thing if you got it to figure out how to fix it, but much better to have never have gotten it. Never to have come down with it. Does that mean we want to get all the fancy suit? Well, I mean, there's a place for this. They do talk about, for medical workers, having a face shield, definitely a mask like the N95 one, gloves, and then the gown with the full regalia, and if you're really on top of it, you might want boots. I mean, if you go to the internet, they're now selling a suit, especially a Class A hazmat suit, perfect for protection from Ebola. But I'm not suggesting everybody go down and buy a hazmat suit. Let's look at how this virus works, how different viruses work, and then we'll talk about how you can boost your immune system, how you can prepare yourself so you'll be among that 70% that never come down with it, instead of that 30% who have to figure out now that they've come down with it, how they can fix themselves. In most viral infections, there's an exponential growth of the virus within cells. And if your immune system is not functioning at this point, the viruses become the winner and you die. But if your immune system is intact, it starts figuring out that something's going on, and the part of your immune system that's especially important for viruses is the natural killer cells and the interferon. And the interferon is the body's own natural antiviral, and the natural killer cells are the guys that go around and check cells out, see if they have viruses in them, and clean up the viruses. Notice we only brought the infection down halfway, though. That's because you need a second part of your immune system intact to totally finish off the viral infection, and that would be your B cells. These are lymphocytes, and they're accompanying the antibodies, IgA, and immunoglobulin A. And so if you have everything intact, two parts of your immune system, then you can bring a viral infection down to, well, so you recover. So I'm going to look at this in the context of what we talk about out at Eden Valley as our eight natural doctors: the pure air, sunlight, abstemiousness, rest, exercise, proper diet, use of water, and trust in God. And we'll see how each one of these, with a certain good advice, will help you keep your immune system in tip-top shape. First of all, pure air. It's good to have pure air. I mean, you go to Southern California, they don't have pure air. We discovered something when we went to Southern California. The people in Southern California no longer have to breathe by faith. They can see what they breathe. And when you can see what you breathe, it's got nasty stuff in it. It can be ozone, sulfur dioxide, you name it. But what this does is it wipes out the immune system, especially in your lungs, and you are set up for more viral infections, whatever type they are. And this would make it so that people in polluted cities would be more likely to come down with the disease and less likely to recover. Now, anytime you have mold in your environment, be it from mold in your basement, mold in your shower, mold in your attic, the mold tends to cause your natural killer cells to quit working. It initiates inflammation. We just said that the virus causes tumor necrosis factor release, which is inflammation. Well, if you already have inflammation in your body from mold being around, you are sort of halfway down the chute already. And so living in a home where it's, you know, maybe you live in a home where we got, this flood came through, then you could have problems, because once that flood's been through there, the different building materials that you can't have access to might have mold. And so people living in New Orleans after the floods there, or different places, tsunami in Japan, are much higher risk than those who have houses that are clean with pure air and no trace of mold. Now, there's another factor that affects your immune system, and that is how many new synthetic building materials you have. They did a big study on a bunch of people who had an office, and the office was due to be remodeled. And when they went to remodel the office, they took the people's blood before they remodeled the office. And then 2 weeks after they had remodeled the office and the people had moved back in, they checked their blood again. And they discovered that these people, when they moved in the office after new carpets and new insulation boards and new desks and chairs and upholstery were put in, had high levels of phenol, formaldehyde, and so forth, and their natural killer cells weren't working very good. And I remember we went out, you know, California's sort of tight on regulations. We went to an RV dealership and we looked inside a camper trailer. On the wall was a plaque. This camper trailer was built with materials known by the state of California to cause cancer. Do you remember the FEMA trailers? after Katrina. Yeah, and people got sick. Well, all these chemicals can wipe out your immune system. So you're much better off being outdoors. There's negative ions in the air outdoors. Those negative ions boost your immune system, and it helps your natural killer cells to work more efficiently. There's less microbes in the air when you have all these negative ions. In fact, in 1918, when they ran out of hospital beds and people were still coming to the hospital sick, they started pitching tents out on the lawn. Guess who survived the flu better?
The ones
out on the lawn. And so they made it a special camp for people to come and live outside instead of going to the hospital. 1918, nurses care for victims of Spanish influenza epidemic outdoors amidst canvas tents during an outdoor fresh air cure. Lawrence, Massachusetts. So I've told people what you need to do is get a tent, go pitch it on your back lawn, and go live in that. A lot of times it's healthier than what we've had in our houses. And the pure air out there with the fragrance of the pine and the fir and the cedar, those are helpful at fighting viruses. You look at pine. Pine oil has been shown to stop the growth of viruses. People use it as sprays, and that's not a bad idea. Citrus also inhibits viruses. And so my stepfather, whenever he gets on an airplane, he carries a little vial of lemon oil with him and has it around his neck on a string and a little wick, and make sure he keeps the air around him well infused with this pleasant odor of lemon. And he's not got a cold when he went on the airplane doing that. How about sunlight? Sunlight has many facets to it that are valuable and beneficial. Now, we said that both the 1918 Spanish influenza and Ebola stopped your body from producing interferon. And that's a big problem, because what will happen next is, even if you survive the pandemic influenza or the Ebola, your immune system is still out of functioning. It's not functioning well for several, maybe 6 weeks or something. And during that time, you can catch the pneumonia or something else that'll get you. But if you've been getting plenty of sunlight, it disables the virus's ability to shut down your interferon production. So you want to get plenty of sunlight. And a lot of people think of sunlight today and vitamin D. And it's true, vitamin D plays an important role in all this. If you're deficient in vitamin D, then you're more likely to get a viral infection. But if you have plenty of vitamin D, it's helpful. Vitamin D protects against excessive expression of inflammatory cytokines. It doesn't let the inflammation get so high. So with the Ebola causing all this inflammation, if you have plenty of vitamin D on board, you're less likely to melt down with inflammation. And it's literally a meltdown. The virus goes in the cell, causes inflammation, and the cells die and turn into mush. But if you have plenty of vitamin D on board, then you will have better outcome, and your natural killer cells will be more active. Sunlight also kills viruses. So if you're outdoors where there's plenty of sunlight, there's going to be fewer viruses floating around. It's the ultraviolet that does this. And people who get out in the sun and get plenty of sunlight have a lot more circulating immune cells for up to 2 weeks after they've been out in the sun for a while. I just say stay in the sun, you know, all the time, but I mean, you don't want to get burned. But how about rest? A lot of people aren't getting enough rest. A lot of people don't get rest before midnight. A lot of people want to stay up and watch TV and catch the, you know, midnight program. But if you're not getting your rest before midnight, say at least 2 hours before midnight, then your interferon is going to have trouble because your melatonin isn't going to be rising. And so you want to get plenty of good rest. People who sleep well have better immune systems than those who have insomnia. Insomnia can also be related to stressful events and the way you handle stress, and stress wipes out your immune system as well. Now, if you did have a vaccine for Ebola, and by the way, there is no vaccine for Ebola, although the CDC says they have a couple candidates on the docket to get tested out. But if you did have a vaccine for, say, bird flu or swine flu or pandemic influenza, but you don't take care of yourself, you could get sick just as likely as if you didn't have the vaccine. And so let's say you had a really good vaccine for the regular, you know, flu. Well, if you don't get sleep, you'll catch the flu anyway. And this has been the case with laboratory animals, where they took laboratory animals and they injected them with a vaccine. And then they put them in two groups, and one group got sleep deprived only one night for 7 hours. And then they gave them all the flu bug, and the mice that didn't get their sleep caught the flu as though they'd never been vaccinated. So when we talk about keeping your immune system up, we're not saying that, you know, it has is going to be instead of a vaccine, but it could be an adjunct to your vaccine. In other words, your vaccine won't work without it. So we're going to give you things that will give you the benefit regardless of what your vaccine is going to do for you. Meditation improves the immune system in studies where they've looked at this. This is like purposeful meditation where you're looking at things, oh, how love I thy law, it is my meditation all the day. Not empty-headed type of meditation. And it's interesting, when they looked at different people's immune system, this was a study in Georgia, they found out that Seventh-day Adventists had higher plasma levels of immune-stimulating antioxidants. But then they discovered that the ones that were vegetarian had even better immune systems. Well, I found it interesting that those who probably had no interest in health still got a benefit from their weekly rest. And so the weekly rest is important as well. So nightly rest, meditation rest, and weekly rest. Exercise. Let's talk about its benefits, because people who get out and exercise moderately. Now, why do I say moderately? Well, you tell a bunch of type A personalities that exercise will help, and pretty soon they join the club to run the marathon. Guess what? That will wipe out your immune system. That'll give you more infectious diseases. You want to do something moderate, easy, something you enjoy, something outdoors, and this helps reduce the risk of viral infections. What kind of clothing you wear is important. If you're wearing things that are too tight around your waist, it changes your blood flow in your abdominal cavity. It changes the way your intestines work, and stagnant blood raises inflammation and lowers your immune system. Tight things around your chest change how big of breath of air you get, and you end up with an immune system that's not going to be as well prepared for fighting Ebola or whatever infectious disease is coming around. Another factor is how warm you keep yourself. It's interesting. If you don't keep your legs as warm as any other part of your body, it makes all the blood get squeezed back up from your legs, and it congests, it pools or stagnates in your chest, abdomen, and pelvis. Stagnant blood raises inflammation, lowers your immune system, and you're more likely to come down with pandemic Ebola or influenza or something like that. All right, let's talk about food, proper diet. How does diet help my immune system? What would be the best diet? Well, you know, I had a dean in high school, and he decided to go on a fresh fruit and vegetable diet. All us students teased him, but he's always healthy. So a few years ago, I gave him a call. I said, how are you doing, George? He says, great. And we talked for a while. And then I said, are you still on like that fresh fruit and vegetable diet? He says, I am. I said, how's that going? He says, well, in 25 years, I've never had a flu or a cold. I've never missed a day of work due to being sick. He says, before that, when I was, you know, doing a lacto-ovo vegetarian diet, I was always sick. I had snot all winter. I was the guy with the flu and the cold. And so the fresh fruit and vegetable diet has been shown to in the studies to be antibiotic, anti-allergic, tumor protective, anti-inflammatory, and it stimulates the immune system. On the other hand, eating things that are high in fat will wipe out your immune system. Low fat, good. 100% natural killer cell activity. Normal fat, i.e. American diet, cuts the immune system in half, 50%. High-fat diet, those eating in a lot of fast food restaurants or eating out, period, cuts the immune system down by 79%. And so you want to go low-fat. You don't want a lot of processed fats. They do not help for cancer or Ebola or any viral disease. especially if the fat contains cholesterol. High cholesterol diet depresses the natural killer cells to 1/4 their usual activity. It's sort of like Monday morning going to work. Everybody's running on 1/4 speed. Well, this is not good. You know, all these guys are not working. It reduces the natural killer cell activity and their interferon production. So you don't want this in your diet if you see Ebola coming around. Or a lot of other things. How about sugar? How does that help? Well, it's not very helpful. Here we have number of bacteria eaten by a white cell. Here we have sugar and immunity. If we eat no sugar in a 12-hour period, then each white cell can consume 14 bacteria. But if you eat 12 teaspoons of sugar, what's a common food with 12 teaspoons of sugar?
Soda.
Yeah, one soda. If you drink one soda, you just cut your immune system down by 60%. Two sodas or one banana split or 24 teaspoons of sugar, and you cut it down to 1/14 or only one bacteria in a 12-hour period. So we're talking things that wipe out the immune system. Sugar does it. So if you want to avoid the Ebola, you don't want to do it with sugar in your diet. Other things may be less obvious. A lot of people realize, yeah, sugar is going to wipe out my immune system, but a lot of people don't realize that milk wipes out your natural killer cells, so that they don't work very good, and it triples your risk of other viral diseases. You know, cancer is a viral disease. A lot of viruses cause cancer. Triples your risk of cancer. And so milk can be part of the problem. Another thing is if you're in an area where you're not getting good nutrition. Now this has been seen as part of the problem over in Africa. Why has Ebola gone so fast in Africa? Poor nutrition often. And it can be poor nutrition due to what you're eating, or it can be poor nutrition due to parasites and you know, competitors. But if you're with a diet that only has 50% of the USRDA of vitamins, then your natural killer cells don't function so well. Now, I used white bread as sort of an illustration for a deficient diet, but you get the idea. So let's look at vitamins and what you need to keep your immune system up and going well, and where you might get those vitamins. And let's start with vitamin A. You want plenty of vitamin A. And certainly carrots are a good source. If you have plenty of vitamin A, then your natural killer cells work well. But if you don't have plenty of vitamin A, they don't function well and their numbers decline. Oh, maybe I'll just take a pill. Will that help me? Actually not. The pills don't seem to work. What you want is like carrots. Well, how many different types of vitamin A are there in a carrot? Actually, in one study, 273 different active forms of vitamin A. Carotenoids, carotenes, retinols, all these fancy things. If you're deficient in them, then your lymphocytes aren't going to make the antibodies to these viruses either. And so you want to have plenty of good food. Now, how much vitamin A is recommended by the USRDA? Well, 5,000 international units. Well, where would I find that? Well, let's see. There's a lot of things that have lots of vitamin A. Carrots have a lot, kale, squash. I mean, you look, but notice there's none in eggs or chicken or beef. If you're eating food that's totally deficient in nutrition, nutritionally poor, then you're going to be a sitting duck for Ebola. You want to make sure you get plenty of good nutrition. Vitamin E is also very important for viruses like influenza. And if you have plenty of vitamin E, then it does benefits for you in case you did get sick. It reduces the viral numbers. It's like virus birth control. It stops them from reproducing so much. It prevents you from losing your appetite. You see, here's the way the viruses work. They shut down your immune system that's controlled by your brain. They send your brain into alpha waves. Since your immune system is controlled by your brain, if your brain is shut down, then your immune system is shut down. That's not good. But if we have plenty of vitamin E on board, it makes it so the virus can't shut down your brain, can't shut down your brain into alpha waves, can't make it so your brain doesn't boost the immune system. And so you need plenty of vitamin E. But do we want pills? Well, not really. The vitamin E also lowers the inflammation. You really want to get it from food. In fact, the studies show that if you take vitamin E pills, tocopherols and that kind of thing, you end up with a higher risk of cancer. The laboratory versions of the vitamins aren't the same as the ones found in nature. It could be just like the vitamin A picture, where there's many different types of vitamin E in certain foods. Foods that would have plenty of vitamin E, where you're trying to get 30 international units per day, would be nuts and seeds, cloves, mixed nuts. Notice there's none in tea, coffee, and sugar. Deficient foods. How about folate or folic acid? When you are deficient in folate or folic acid, you end up with natural killer cells that don't function. And so you want to get plenty of folate. They did a study on this and they found out that they could reverse the deficiency with diet, or they could reverse it with supplementation. The diet did a little better at boosting the immune system than the supplementation. Then they decided to combine the two. Bad idea. The people's immune system got worse than if they had done neither. And so you want to look to diet as the best way to get your folate. And arrowroot, it's a thickener you can buy in the stores. You need about 400 micrograms per day. Wheat germ, peanuts, sunflower seeds. Again, this is a lot of the nuts and seeds. Lentils, beans, parsley, oats. Spinach is a good one. And it's often thought of as being a great source of folate. Notice none in potato chips, none in soda pop. Yes. How about vitamin C? Who is it that popularized vitamin C? Linus Pauling. That's right. But he wanted you to take mega doses. But vitamin C does have its benefits. It is an antioxidant. It reduces the inflammation in the body due to viruses, and it reduces the symptoms of viral illnesses, and it helps boost the immune system. You only need 60 milligrams, according to the USRDA, not 600 milligrams, not 6,000, not 10 grams. I've heard as much as 75 grams being given folks. And where would I find it? Well, I could get some from strawberries, bell peppers, chives, red cabbage. Notice there's more in red cabbage than there is in lemons or oranges. Notice there's none in fish. Why not? Well, the fish didn't eat the vitamin C to pass it on to you. They used it for themselves so they wouldn't get sick. And then they don't have any left in their muscles to hand off to you. So you end up eating basically just protein with no nutrition. Now, there's certain minerals you don't want to be deficient in. Selenium. This is very important for fighting viruses. And people who are sufficient with their selenium have an increased natural killer cell activity. They have less inflammation in their tissues from the viruses. And once the virus does take off and cause problems, they recover more quickly. And so you need plenty of selenium. The USRDA is 70 micrograms, not very much. What are those things? That's where you want to get it. Brazil nuts have a lot. You could eat one of those a day and get plenty of selenium. But mixed nuts probably do the Brazil nuts. Sesame seeds. Excuse me. And all the different seeds and nuts and so forth. Notice there's some in oat bran. A lot of the minerals in grains is in the bran. So when they make white flour and refined products, they take away the minerals. All right, zinc is very important for your immune system. Where do you get zinc? Oh, nails. No, just kidding. Galvanized nails. And you've heard of these cough drops that have zinc in case you're getting a cold. It's effective. It's helpful. It's part of the way an antibody kills a virus or bacteria has to do with something we call in biochemistry the zinc finger. Well, this is where you need the zinc. And so the amount of zinc necessary, though, for your immune system might be a little more than for normal growth. USRDA is based more on your normal growth and metabolism. So maybe you need 20 milligrams instead of 15. But anyway, wheat germ, pumpkin seeds is a very good source. Pumpkin seeds boost your immune system, help get rid of parasites. Pumpkin seeds are very good. Sesame seeds. pine nuts, maple sugar. Oh, I'm going to go for that one. No, no, no. That might not be your best source for all your zinc. Okay, grapes. Let's talk about individual foods. We're getting off the vitamins now onto individual foods. And grapes have phytochemicals that fight viruses. Resveratrol is one of those. And the grapes, they usually study the red grapes, but grapes will help fight viruses so you don't have as many of them growing. It's more viral, inhibition. Now, what happens if you get plenty of grapes on board is it improves your survival, especially like in laboratory animals, so that we figure it's good for humans. Now, what is it if you eat one a day that the doctor stays away? An apple. Apples are very good, and they also fight viruses. I had a gentleman who came to a lecture back. We were doing a similar lecture back when bird flu was an issue. And he said every year he ate an apple a day, and he never got the flu. And then somebody gave him a box of oranges, so he started eating an orange a day, and then he got the flu that year. Now, I'm not saying there's anything bad with oranges, but there is something especially good about apples. And people who eat an apple a day have better lung function. In fact, they breathe an extra 150 milliliters of air with every breath. And their lungs are more resistant to the viruses. And so apples are very beneficial. Garlic, super good. In one study, they looked at people who lived in close proximity in communal living over in Israel, kibbutz, farming communities. And so everybody lives in one big house and they all, breathe each other's air. Anyway, they gave half the people in the house garlic supplement pills, kaolic garlic type stuff. And when they did that, the people who got the garlic had 63% fewer viral illnesses. How's that for a good reduction? So you definitely want to be doing the garlic, and you know, you chew on it and it smells so wonderful. It helps with social distancing. In 1918, it's reported about a group of people who all ate garlic every day and none of them came down with the pandemic influenza of that era. Onions also contain good things, same family, and they help keep the inflammation from building up as a result of the viruses. And the particular phytochemical is quercetin. It's also found in apples and green leafy vegetables and beans. Now, it's been interesting to note that for some of the studies, that selective estrogen receptor modulators inhibit Ebola virus infection. So if you can think of foods that actually modulate or affect estrogen receptors, you're looking at foods that could be helpful for a number of reasons. For example, turmeric, flax, soy, all are estrogen receptor modulators. And so these would be very helpful foods. I mean, soy has been shown to be antioxidant. It boosts the immune system. And it not only shows benefits for viruses, but for certain cancers. Of course, you don't want genetically modified soy, but it's very beneficial. Other things that are hormonal modulators are your cruciferous vegetables, cabbage, broccoli, kale, cauliflower, kohlrabi, all those family of things. And those phytochemicals then could also be helpful. So part of your diet when you're looking at this should include some good raw cabbage, or cooked, but raw is usually better. Turmeric is also very anti-inflammatory, as well as having estrogen receptor modulating effects. So you can use this. Usually you can just buy it in the store and put it on different things. So a lot of people use it when they make tofu to color it a little bit yellow, to sort of give it the egg color so it looks like scrambled eggs. But it's a very beneficial thing. And it inhibits some of those inflammatory cytokines that will cause tissue damage. So that's a good thing. I've seen it in stores as a root. You can buy it as a root. I've seen it in stores as the powder. You can buy it in the health food store in a capsule if you don't care for the taste of it. It's not a strong taste. It's really a root vegetable over in India. It's not like, hot sauce or anything like that. Okay, well, When you eat a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables, does it really make a difference? Well, the studies show it does. Compared to omnivores, vegans had much higher levels, actually 3 times as much vitamin A, vitamin C, and vitamin E. And so they looked at their natural killer cells and discovered that their natural killer cell activity was twice as energetic as people eating the other foods. Well, what kind of diet are we talking about? Isn't it the original diet? The Genesis diet, right? Fruits, grains, nuts, vegetables. Then God said, "Behold, I've given you Snickers bars." No, 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 no. That's apocryphal. All right, and now we have to talk about something else that's helpful, and that is avoiding the things that wipe out your immune system. People who smoke. Smokers are 1.5 times more likely to catch a viral illness, and they're much more likely to miss work due to the viral illness. In other words, they get sicker. People who drink, it wipes out the natural killer cells. That alcohol is not helping your immune system, and you're more likely to come down with a disease. Well, you might be thinking, yeah, we don't smoke, we don't drink. But y'all eat. And you know, if you eat too much food, you wipe out your immune system. Now I'm going to get very unpopular, telling people not to eat so much. I better hide behind this pulpit, right? Well, actually, studies show if you eat 60% less food, your natural killer cells will quadruple in numbers, fourfold, and their activity will be twice as much. This is like you have 4 times as many soldiers, and they're twice as energetic. How's that? So when you see the Ebola coming around, don't go out and have a big party and feast and avoid birthday parties. They don't eat good food at birthday parties. If you combine alcohol and tobacco together, the effect is multiplicative. It's much worse. Now let's talk about the use of water. This gentleman looks like he needs to drink his water, huh? And the studies that show us the most about water are the studies in nursing homes, where we discover that if people get dehydrated, they get constipated, they get urinary tract infections, lung infections, they have renal failure, they have electrolyte imbalances, they have trouble with their wounds healing. And so you don't want to get low on water. You want to maybe hyperhydrate. What would hyperhydrate be? Maybe drink close to 1 gallon of water a day. It wouldn't hurt. But we don't just use water to keep you well hydrated. We want to use it as a treatment. So if I was feeling a little bit sick, like as if somebody had passed off their flu or their Ebola or whatever to me, then I would head to the shower. That's the easiest way for me to do hydrotherapy at my place. And I would get in there and I would turn it as hot as I could stand. Now, there's several different ways you can do this, but I'll tell you how I do it. And then I'll give you an easier way to do it. And I just turn it as hot as I can stand until I feel a fever commence, maybe after 10 minutes. Well, how do you know what a fever feels like? Well, the first time I did it, I kept a thermometer in my mouth to see when my temperature went up. Oh, so that's what you feel like when you make your temperature go up. So now when I make my temperature go up, I sort of hark back to that feeling and realize that I'm getting my temperature up. So I know I've made a difference in my temperature. I boosted it a little bit. It usually takes about 10 minutes. Then I switch to cold. And I do cold for a whole minute. Excuse me. And after a minute of cold, then I'll go back to hot maybe 1 more time, maybe 2 more times. But if I'm doing it this way and it's taking about 10 minutes, I usually only do it 1 more time. And then I end with cold and then I go to bed, maybe for the night or maybe for a half hour. Usually that will make it so I don't have the flu the next morning or the cold or whatever it was. The other way you can do it is you can just time it. Some people do 3 minutes hot, 1 minute cold, 3 minutes hot, 1 minute cold. Some people do 3 minutes hot and only do a half a minute of cold. 3 minutes hot, 1 minute, 1 half minute cold. So you can decide if you're going to be macho and do a whole, no, I'm just kidding. But a good minute. After you've done, if you've done it where you've raised your temperature, you really like the cold at that point. It feels good. You're like, I think I'll stay in the cold a little longer. Another thing that's good for an immune system is taking a cool bath. Oh, wait a minute, I sort of like my bath to be warm. Well, but the benefits are much better for a cool bath. Most people receive benefit from a cool or tepid bath every day, morning or evening. Instead of increasing the liability to take cold, a bath properly taken fortifies against cold. And in the studies where they did this to military recruits, They stuck them in a bunch of 64-degree water for a while. That's pretty cold. That's a little colder than your swimming pool. Yeah. Anyway, they stuck them in cold water for a while and then sent them out on bivouac, and they did much better. Their natural killer cells were much more active, much less likely for the people to come down with any kind of viral illness. But cool doesn't have to be 64 degrees, just a little bit cool. Now let's talk about real hydrotherapy, and that's like we do out at Eden Valley. And here was from the 1918 Spanish influenza study done in 1919 of some of the results of what happened. And they compared to army hospitals, which were the best of the day, and they compared it to doing outpatient hydrotherapy, sort of like we were talking about there, or doing it in a sanitarium like we have out at Eden Valley. And if you went to the army hospital with the viral illness, then 17% of patients came down with a pneumonia and 7% died. If you did home hydrotherapy, like we're talking either hot and cold showers or hot and cold other treatments, then 9% came down with a pneumonia and 4% died. And if you went to the sanitarium where you had a whole crew to do the hot and cold on you, 1% came down with a pneumonia and only 0.5% died. And so the natural therapies using water treatments with hot and cold were much more effective than some of the other treatments that were going on in the day. Another thing that's very valuable is charcoal. And so if I'm coming down with something, I will make a charcoal drink. I'll take a quart of water, I'll put in a tablespoon of charcoal powder, and I'll mix it in. This is charcoal, medicinal charcoal, not charcoal briquettes. You can buy it online. We got a card back there on our table you can pick up to know where to buy it. It's buyactivatedcharcoal.com. And we got a book back there on charcoal. We got a resource table back there. We have a free handout for you at the end of the lecture here, though. But anyway, drink 1 or 2 teaspoons of activated charcoal powder. I usually drink it in a quart of water. It binds viruses. It takes them out of your system. It lowers inflammation. It stops the process.
Do you do that daily or just when you feel something?
I would do it daily till I felt better.
So but if you feel something coming on.
Yeah. If I feel like it's coming on, then I would do it daily until I was feeling better.
Will that make you constipated everywhere?
Some people get constipated if they take that much. Then you might want to take a teaspoon of psyllium with it. And I found people who get constipated who take a teaspoon of psyllium with their charcoal powder don't get constipated so readily.
Drink plain water with it.
Drink plain water with it. Or you can drink it with anything you like to drink, too. Kids may not like the water, so you might put it in some kind of their favorite juice or something. Or
I just
drink.
Got over a UTI a few weeks ago. That's all I did was take that and drink cranberry juice.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
He says he's going to mix it in with his beer. No. All right, trust in God. Does it make a difference? In the studies, they call it religiosity or spirituality. And when they look at the immune system, they find out that it boosts the immune system. It helps the natural killer cells. It increases the antibodies, IgA, in your tears and so forth, in your respiratory tract. It's helpful. On the other hand, being depressed will wipe out your immune system. Depression affects whether your lymphocytes or your natural killer cells are working. And so there's a connection between your mind and your body. Stress wipes out your immune system, increases the stress hormones, and makes it so the natural killer cells aren't as active. And it affects the number of respiratory tract infections you get, the more stress you have. 5 minutes of anger significantly reduces IgA levels for up to 5 hours. So if you're really angry that you think somebody let Ebola into your neighborhood, it's worse off than just protecting your immune system and being happy. When you live to help others, you are benefited. Your immune system has helped. In fact, in one study, mortality, dying, was significantly reduced for individuals who provided support to friends, relatives, neighbors, and their spouse. On the other hand, just receiving support had no benefit. So it is more blessed to give than to receive. Any amount of volunteering for community projects reduces mortality by 60%, even among weekly attendees at religious services. And so there's a benefit, more blessed to give than to receive. Well, in summary, utilize sanitary precautions to reduce exposure to viruses, maybe get a mask. Don't eat biblically unclean meats, maybe not even eat any meat. Do all you can to boost your immune system. And the way you do that is eat nutritious, balanced food diet. Be sure to eat a variety of foods, including plenty of vegetables, fruits, beans, nuts, seeds, whole grains. Avoid salt, sugar, alcohol, cholesterol, saturated fat, things that will knock your immune system out. Drink plenty of water, exercise on a regular basis, and get plenty of rest. And as the health inspectorate of the Netherlands said, it's like the Surgeon General of the Netherlands, the only thing more difficult than planning would be explaining why you didn't do it if this thing takes off. Well, we have a website you can go and check out, northernlightshealtheducation.com. It'll be at the top of your handout here. Do I have a volunteer to help hand out the handouts here? Let's see. Oh, all right. Thank you, Argentina. Just give him out as you need him there. All right. And on our website, we have resources, other links. We have a link to the charcoal site and so forth. Presentation handouts. You can download a PDF version of this if you want to email it to somebody. Although I have it under a different title on my website, it's the pandemic preparedness handout, newsletters, make a donation, online videos, you can watch me give some of these lectures online, DVDs. In the back we have a resource table. Now today I've talked to you about how to prevent the disease. What if you got it? We have a video back there on pandemic influenza that covers how to treat a pandemic virus infection like Ebola, like SARS, like Spanish influenza. It's an hour and a half with demonstrations where me and a physical therapist and a physical therapy aide go through and demonstrate how to do the hot and cold treatments and how to do the different types of treatments that would be beneficial, including we sit there and drink charcoal, things have all our black mustaches. All right, so website, a couple of different ways you can get there. And now, any more questions? Any questions? Questions about our topic tonight?